Okay, I think we'll go ahead and get started. It looks like we have the panelists all in place that'll be participating in this session. We'll be having a discussion on going concern, and Bella Rivshin, Associate Chief Auditor and the Office of the Chief Auditor, will moderate this. So I'll turn it over to you, Bella.
Thank you, Jennifer, and welcome to the last leg of the meeting. Our next topic is a panel discussion on matters relating to the auditor's consideration of an entity's ability to continue as a going concern. Historically, the U.S. requirements to evaluate an entity's ability to continue as a going concern have resided in the auditing standards. On October 9, 2008, the FASB issued a proposed accounting standard, going concern, to require that an entity assess its ability to continue as a going concern. In addition, recent events in the financial markets and the current economic environment have highlighted the importance of evaluating an entity's ability to continue as a going concern. At the last SAG meeting in October, the Standing Advisory Group discussed audit considerations relating to the current economic environment. As a result of that discussion, the staff issued PCAOB Staff Audit Practice Alert Number 3 in December 2008 to assist auditors in identifying audit risks and other issues related to the current economic environment, including the importance of evaluating an entity's ability to continue as a going concern. As background, the going concern assumption is the assumption that the entity has the financial ability to continue to operate. The PCAOB auditing standards impose on the auditor a responsibility to evaluate whether there's substantial doubt about an entity's ability to continue as a going concern for a reasonable period of time not to exceed 1 year beyond the date of the financial statements being audited. At today's meeting, the discussion will address the potential effects of the current economic environment and the FASB proposed accounting standard on the auditor's responsibilities under the standards of the PCAOB. The panel, consisting of four participants, will present background information regarding the going concern topic. The panelists are Peter Perstakis, Assistant Director of Technical Activities at the FASB and today's observer representing the FASB. We've all heard him speak today. Randy Fletchall, current SAG member and America's Vice Chair for Professional Practice and Risk Management and member of the America's Executive Board at Ernst & Young. Stephen Rafferty, current SAG member and professional practice partner at BKD. And Joe Carcello, another current SAG member and Director of Research at the Corporate Governance Center and Ernst & Young professor at the University of Tennessee. With that, I would like to get ready to start. Peter, I will turn over the mic to you and for you to cover your prepared remarks.
Thank you, Bella. Maybe the theme here is if you like fair value accounting, you're going to love the look forward time horizon. The board took this on thinking that it was appropriate to include in the accounting literature management's responsibility for assessing going concern and the requisite disclosures that go around that. It came up as part of really putting together the codification of U.S. accounting standards, but probably in spite of the codification, we would have gotten here at some point. So what we did was try to provide guidance on how that assessment would be made. We absolutely leveraged the guidance that already existed in the auditing standards, carrying over some of the same disclosures and adding some additional disclosures. The comment period closed on December 8th, and what I want to do is talk about four areas where we received comments and how the board addressed those comments in its redeliberations. The first one had to do with the comment that while we had all this guidance in the proposal about assessing the going concern assumption, the viability of the entity to continue as a going concern, we did not define what a going concern is. And so the board talked about that and decided that it would, again, just use the description that was already included in AU 341. And so we're picking up the wording that it talks about ordinarily, and it really is the opposite of going concern, and I'm sure you're all familiar with it. The ordinarily information that significantly contradicts the going concern assumption relates to the entity's inability, et cetera, et cetera. There was some discussion about changing that to state it in the positive, but even at that, the board didn't want to risk possibly changing how it might be interpreted. So we're just lifting that. The second area was disclosures. The proposal carried over the disclosures in paragraph 10 of AU 341 that talks about disclosing the events that cast doubt. We added a disclosure that if the financial statements were not prepared on a basis of a going concern, that fact should be stated, and the reasons should also be described. We had comments that we received that suggested we should make it crystal clear that disclosures about those situations that cast doubt on the entity's ability to continue as a going concern should be disclosed even when they're mitigated by management's plans. And so we're in the final stages of drafting, but the words that I have are that we would say something to the effect of disclosing the material uncertainties even if resolved by management plan. The third area has to do with the look-forward period and the level of information that would have to be assessed. In the proposal, we refer to all available information, which is at least but not limited to 12 months. The board did that because they were trying to avoid a bright line of 12 months, 365 days. For obvious reasons, there could be something significant that occurs thereafter, but the board really did not intend it to be a multi-year assessment. They were thinking in terms of about a year, but not to cut off at 12 months. So we certainly, and we did that to conform with the IFRS, with International Accounting Standards Number 1, that refers to all available information about the future, which is at least but not limited to 12 months. So we had a lot of comments on that. Comments that it was seemingly indefinite, that the notion of all information was too broad, and there was concerns about the legal ramifications of being second-guessed using hindsight about the information that was considered or not considered. So in redeliberations, the board considered a few options. One was to just leave it at the one-month time horizon, just limit it to 12 months. Another was to limit it to 1 year, to 12 months, but to bolster some of the disclosures about risks and uncertainties. The third was to select a fixed time horizon that was more than 12 months. And the fourth option they considered was to retain the concept of not limiting it to 12 months, but to try to tighten up the wording so that it was clear that we're not looking for a multi-year forecast. So in the final standard, we're going to use words such as take into account available information, dropping the all information about the foreseeable future, which is generally, but not limited to 12 months from the end of the reporting period. So the key there is dropping all and adding generally. Certain events that are expected to occur or reasonably foreseeable beyond 12 months and would materially affect the going concern assessment are considered part of the foreseeable future. We have a phrase in here that the time frame beyond 12 months is limited to a practical time thereafter in which significant events or conditions that may affect the evaluation can be identified. And then in the basis for conclusions, we have a sentence that says the board did not intend for the assessment of the period beyond a year to be open-ended or an indefinite period. So we're trying to tighten it up some, and obviously trying not to go all the way back to 12 months, but to tighten it up to some degree. The final area I'll just mention quickly was the effective date. At the time that we did the proposal, because we were bringing the literature into the codification, that was our mindset at the time, we thought that it would just be effective at the time that the codification of U.S. GAAP was effective, which the target date is July 1. And we had some comment that came back that, one, that could be the middle of a reporting season for a June 30 period. And also, by connecting it to the codification, it's possible it just could be missed. And I guess if you're not as focused on the codification, then you could miss it. So the board simply made two decisions. One, because we intended to publish in March, now it looks like it's going to be early April, they retained the idea that it would be effective for June reporting. Second, we're going to state it apart from connecting it to the codification. So like every other standard that we issue, it'll have an effective date of periods ending after June 15th, 2009. Those are all the comments I had.
Randy Fletchall.
Thank you, Bill. Let me start by saying I think this is a very timely topic, although in hindsight, I wish maybe we would have spent even more time on this in October, because this was certainly, along with fair value, goodwill impairments, going concern was one of the things that made for a pretty tough reporting season. So perhaps it would have been even more helpful if we'd done it then. But I hope we can learn maybe from the experiences we went through as we look at what the PCB might do going forward and as the FASB finalizes that standard. Let me start by saying we're obviously very supportive of the FASB taking the initiative to provide guidance in the accounting literature on the assessment of going concern and to make explicit that it is a management responsibility to evaluate an entity's ability to continue as a going concern. Going concern is a very fundamental, critical assertion in financial reporting, but historically in the United States, the requirements for that have been embedded in the auditing standards. And as mentioned in the briefing paper, those requirements have been there for quite some time. We've had many tough discussions, as I said, during the year, and I will tell you there's certainly a lack of understanding of what that auditing standard means, particularly when you get outside of auditors. And so I'm reminded a little bit of the parallel to Section 404 reporting a few years back, when there was a need for guidance separate and distinct from the auditing standards to be issued by the SEC, so the preparers, and while different, aligned guidance, but preparers didn't feel like they were having to deal with auditing standards to dictate what they were supposed to do, but to be able to turn to the accounting standards and say, here's what I look for when I'm supposed to do as part of my assessment, here's what I should be disclosing, and so on. So I really do think it's a step in the right direction. In addition to the FASB finalizing its standard and the PCAOB considering whether or not to do anything with its standard, I guess I would suggest that maybe there's a need for just some further outreach and education so that there's a common understanding of going concern and some of the definitions and issues among all stakeholders. The auditing standard, I date myself, I go back to SAS 59 with an AU 341 perhaps, has been around for a long time. I'm told that some very, very senior audit partners understand the workings of that, or at least they think they understand it. But truly, among management teams, audit committees, and many auditors, there's less than a complete understanding, because in fact, it's not something that you apply in every year's audit. While you consider it if there are certain conditions and events that emerge, we're at a time where clearly there are many companies that I would say for the first time ever, or at least in a long, long time, had very serious conversations with their auditors about going concern, what the requirements of AU 341 are, and what the implications might be. Investors, I know, are concerned whenever a company fails, and the prior audit report didn't have a going concern modification, and that's a perspective we've got to stay focused on. But my experience this year has been that management teams and audit committees really believe that we're predicting their doom, and maybe contributing to their demise, that the going concern opinion, when it's, or the going concern modification, is truly saying that they are failing and going out of business, and that's the prediction we're making. And I don't think that's what the standard actually says, and that's not how we've been applying it, but that's the way it strikes them sometimes. I might save some of my comments, Joe, till after your presentation. Chairman Olson last night mentioned how all of you come to the meeting so prepared. Joe really comes prepared. As part of his panel, he's got a whole bunch of slides to make us look bad. But I was struck by one as I glanced through them. He said, "You mean you didn't glance through all of them?" One of them talked about the fact that auditors, Joe said, seem to spend a lot of time in looking at going concern from a standpoint of status of debt financing. Is that right? And yet, so a lot of the going concern modifications ended up as a result of a debt financing status. And yet the research showed that that's not necessarily a good predictor or indicator of bankruptcy. And so if that's truly what people want a going concern modification to portend, bankruptcy, then maybe we're looking at the wrong things. I don't think so, but at least it was interesting that we certainly have always thought debt financing status was a key ingredient, and it seems like we're not alone based on those findings. And yet Joe's research would suggest maybe that's not as important. That was interesting. Let me return to the FASB's proposed standard, because one concern we still have, Peter, I think, is the time horizon for the assessment. As was mentioned, we've had this reasonable time period being not to exceed 1 year from the balance sheet date. The FASB standard started with a reasonable period being at least but not limited to 12 months from the date of the financial statements. I didn't hear you say, in terms of where you might be headed, using the just beyond language that I think was in the basis of conclusion last time, and frankly, I think that would be helpful given all the words that I heard. I see a thumbs down, but maybe we could get you to reconsider that one. I do think it is awfully, awfully important, and I think you'll hear today from my colleagues and from others that when you start extending this thing out to some indefinite period and being reluctant to somehow put a time frame around this, the expectation gap just widens and widens. And so while I know there is a fondness these days to not have bright lines, 12 months from the balance sheet date, these are annual financial statements. It's a concept that's pretty well understood. And while I mentioned some things in AU 341 might not be well understood, that 1 year really is. And when you go beyond that, I think you add to the expectation gap. I think you add to some implementation difficulties. We've thought about, if you need to go to your bank to get a waiver of debt covenant violations, what period of time do you get it for? It's no longer 12 months in a day. What period of time is someone going to decide is reasonable to be looking at? And so I think it adds to some difficulties to, again, something that's already pretty difficult. With this heading to a final statement, and management now having responsibility to explicitly assess going concern and make disclosures, it seems like it is a time to reconsider, at least, what should the auditor's report look like? And I think there are various alternatives. You could actually decide that you need no mention of a company's disclosures about a going concern assessment, in that there are lots of material uncertainties in a set of financial statements, and readers are expected to look at the footnotes. This one is no different, and you don't need to even address it. I think there's another middle ground one could look at that is more of a reference, that not every set of financial statements will have that disclosure, because not everyone will think they get in the situation that requires them to make the disclosure. So you could merely point the reader of the financial statements, like you do a change in accounting standards, adopting a new accounting standard, point the reader to management's footnote and discussion, and merely indicate that it's there. Now, having that would tell a reader, this is different than other companies. This one actually has made some disclosures about a going concern assessment, and substantial doubt, or about material uncertainties and the plans they've mitigated. So it would still signal the reader, here's something you might want to go look at in this set of financial statements that's not in some other company's financial statements. And obviously a third would be to keep the explanatory paragraph that we have today. But I would suggest you might, even if you keep it, think about the words. I think we've always struggled with the words substantial doubt. And I'll tell you, having gone through many tough discussions this year and had many communications, substantial doubt about continued existence as a going concern just adds to your saying that I'm going to fail within the next 12 months. And by the time you get your audit report, it's actually less than 12 months. And we're not sure that's really what it means. So I guess we might give some consideration to what's the best way to communicate in an explanatory paragraph if one were retained. And maybe the focus ought to be more on the material uncertainties that exist and not these six or seven words that seem to signal to people something much different maybe than what people intend. I'll stop it. I didn't answer any questions. I just teamed this one up, and I think we've got more to come.
Thank you, Randy. Steve Rafferty.
Thank you. Based on where this might end up, I'd really like to go back to the liability cap discussion that Kurt brought up earlier. But based on what Bella asked me to do, I'll take a different direction, a little bit different than what Randy did, but I probably will reiterate some of the same comments. But what I'd like to do is talk a little bit about, for the benefit of the non-auditors here, the current environment, sort of how auditors approach these evaluations and management's forecasts, a little bit about our attitude about the reporting issues, FASB's proposal, and then perhaps a little bit about if we need additional guidance here, where do folks think we might need some additional guidance? First of all, I mean, for auditors, this is risky business, a very contentious area, very difficult area for auditors to address, always has been. And if folks, you know, you look at the current environment and you say, well, auditors are using their crystal ball to do this, I think we all kind of feel like we need to reprogram our crystal balls today because things are much different than they have been in the past. We can't predict things like we could in the past. We're seeing many more entities undergo these considerations, especially in certain industries. For example, entities or industries that might support, like the auto industry and others, are just really severely impacted by the economy. Frequently, this is a dependency on financing of one kind or another. One of my partners the other day said it very well. In a going concern consideration, cash is truly king, because it often does focus on liquidity issues. But in today's environment, you know, what you might assume about an entity's ability to refinance or raise capital are far different than what you might have assumed 6, 9, 12 months ago. And so it's kind of like all bets are off when you go through these considerations. I think we're probably ending up with, because of that and because of the current environment, entities that are getting modified opinions that a year ago with a similar set of circumstances would not have. And I'm not saying that's at all inappropriate. But we just simply can't guess whether a company can get financing, can raise capital, and do some of those things that seem pretty logical and pretty obvious in the past. Going concern evaluations are extremely subjective, often very contentious with our clients. Sometimes, unfortunately, sort of last-minute crashes when people just don't focus on them early enough in the audit process. Again, they often hinge on cash flows, which might be cost-cutting, might be financing, might be raising capital, might be better operations in the future. And that's one of the most difficult aspects of these evaluations for the auditor, is if management's plan is really to do better into the future. That's terribly difficult to evaluate, particularly in an economy like we have today. Management is always going to be optimistic in their forecast of the future, in some cases overly optimistic, in some cases just downright unrealistic. And getting into the underlying assumptions for those forecasts is something that the auditor clearly has to do, but perhaps one of the most difficult things that we as auditors have to do to drill down into what is management really thinking, how do these assumptions differ from the past, how is management forecasted in the past compared to their actual operations in the past. It's a very difficult area, and for many firms, this is one of the primary reasons that if we do have a going concern consideration on an audit, that it is a matter of consultation with quality control people in our firm so that we have two sets of really experienced eyes looking at these issues. With respect to reporting, as Randy said, I think this is an area that certainly worries auditors a lot. We worry that we won't modify opinion and then the company will fail. We also worry that we might be just driving nails in a coffin and have liability from that standpoint as well. And in some cases, you might look at an entity where the auditor has put a going concern opinion on it for 3-4 years in a row. On the one hand, you might say, well, therefore you were by definition wrong 3 out of 4 years, or it could be as well that the company simply overcame the odds. Difficult to tell. But certainly for a client that goes 3-4 years in a row with a going concern modification, they would like to argue that you're being a little more conservative than you should be. In some cases, I think you're asking an auditor to modify a report, you know, really forces the auditor, does force the auditor to get to this notion of substantial doubt, which is not well-defined and terribly subjective. And clearly, maybe you get a different opinion from one firm than you would from another. You might get a different opinion depending on how deep that firm might dig into the deals, into the details and management's assumptions. It's a terribly subjective area. But I will admit that modifying it in the opinion certainly does bring attention to the issue to the benefit of the reader. I understand that. Looking at the FASB proposal, I think my observations are, again, similar to Randy's. I think it appropriately places responsibility on the preparers, which I think is very appropriate because it really is an accounting issue that deals with the basis of accounting primarily, far more so than an audit responsibility or an audit issue. It focuses more attention on the disclosure of the issue so that readers are better informed. I think that's a very positive step. And sometimes I would step back and say, you know, in a perfect world, if you had this stuff disclosed appropriately, why ask an auditor to determine whether there is substantial doubt? Certainly the auditor has seen more of the details of the issues that might give rise to that concern, but are they sometimes in a better position to make this prediction about whether there's substantial doubt or not? You know, when you look at the critical issues of can this entity raise capital in today's environment? Can this entity raise financing? Can they improve their margins? Can they increase their volume of business? Can they really cut costs with this plan? And ask yourself, who in this room can predict that any better than anybody else? But yet we take auditors and say we are placing that burden on you to say whether the cumulative weight of that is substantial doubt or not. And I sometimes question whether would we be better off providing even more disclosure to the readers of the financial statements about those issues and let them make their own conclusions, perhaps with Randy's notion of a reference to that footnote that discloses that without a conclusion of substantial doubt. And for example, with respect to more disclosure, again, often these hinge on financing. There's nothing in the requirement that forces a company to talk about what their financing plan really is and whether they have any kind of verbal or written commitment for that financing or what the nature of that financing even is. If their viability depends upon improved operations, there's nothing in the standard that requires the disclosure of the underlying assumptions and management's forecast about how those operations will really improve. If that were disclosed, I would submit to you that a lot of readers could make their own informed decision about how substantial they thought the doubt was. So that's I'm not arguing that that's necessarily where we go and that the auditors don't have a responsibility to report on this, but I think there's a balance between do we give more information to readers and point them in that direction versus having somebody make this terribly subjective determination of substantial doubt. With respect to the 12-month period, I share the same concerns, and I gravitate more towards about a two-week time frame than a 12-month time frame, particularly today. But I think I would have a hard time believing all auditors don't share the same concerns that the farther we go out, the less reliable our assessment of the issues is. And we are concerned about, does this get settled in practice by the firms? Does it get settled by plaintiff's counsel? Or where does this go if we don't shore up the language and tighten this time frame? And certainly auditors are concerned about how much they're on the hook and how far into the future. And, you know, with respect back to auditors having to make a conclusion, one other observation I have is that, you know, the real job of auditors is to assess the financial statements taken as a whole and provide an opinion on those. But this seems to be sort of an exception where the literature carves the auditor out and says, oh, but you have to make this one other opinion about whether you think there's substantial doubt, which really is not speaking to the financial statements taken as a whole, given appropriate disclosure of the circumstances surrounding the enterprise. With respect to guidance that auditors, I think, might need, one second. The FASB teased this up as management making a conclusion about whether substantial doubt has been alleviated. So the question I have in my mind is, where does that put the auditor's role? Does the auditor have to come to their own conclusion about whether substantial doubt exists or not, or do they have to challenge management's assessment and whether they have a reasonable basis for their conclusion, or do they simply have to point the reader to that footnote and make sure that management's disclosures are not misleading? I don't have a very good answer for that at this point. Some folks would argue that auditors need additional guidance regarding the evaluation of management's plans and whether those can be effectively implemented, and the evaluation of forecasted results, which again is one of the most difficult things that we do. I would tend to disagree. I think the guidance that's in the AU 341 now is appropriate. I think the reason some people say we need more guidance is because it's difficult. Some things are just difficult and require a lot of judgment, and additional guidance isn't going to help. Each one of these instances is very case-specific, and that's why it requires seasoned auditors with good judgment to do this. Some believe that the audit standards should require consideration in planning as well as in the conclusion of the audit. And while that might not be a bad idea, because we do have some last-minute fire drills to address these issues, I think we may not need additional guidance. We just need auditors to do a better job. And I think if you're really on top of these issues, you get there. I can't recall an instance where we ever just failed to identify the issues that might give rise to a going concern consideration. I just don't think that very often happens. That's it for me.
Thank you, Steve. Joe Porcello.
Well, you're going to get a different perspective from me than you got from Randy and Steve, which is probably not surprising. So before I begin, I feel like I have to, I feel compelled to address some of the things that they said. They mentioned how this is a very contentious decision, and I have heard that, and I don't doubt that. But I would question, and I think this is a rhetorical question to both the SEC and the PCAOB. The client is supposed to be the audit committee, and I chair the audit committee of the third largest county in the state of Tennessee. And my objective is just getting good information and getting the answers right. And if this is a contentious discussion, it sounds to me like the discussion is often happening between the auditor and management. And the discussion should be between the auditor and the audit committee. The second issue is there was some discussion if a going concern opinion was issued for 2, 3, 4 years, were those wrong? Well, in approximately 2001, Warren Buffett called credit default swaps financial weapons of mass destruction. Was he wrong or just prescient? The third issue would be some discussion of just disclose going concern issues. Don't make a subjective opinion. All users of the financials are equally positioned to make this judgment. Well, the last time I checked, the SEC's tag was, we are the investor's advocate. Auditors are on site for weeks or months. If they don't know something more than individual investors and some institutional investors, then I would argue that inadequate learning has taken place during that time. So I'm sure Randy and Steve will respond to my criticisms. But with that said, let me move forward with my slides. So I was asked to talk about what do we know about going concern from the academic literature, which I have done. But I also thought it would be useful to gather some real data. Obviously, I'm not bashful about giving my opinion, but rather than just giving my opinion the whole time, we've actually pulled empirical data. And I want to thank Colin Reed, who's a PhD student at the University of Tennessee, who is gratefully helpful to me in pulling this together. But I tee it up here. This is a website. Those of you in public accounting should probably pay attention to this. If you don't, for some reason, students really find this website cool. Students told me about this. I had never heard of it before. And this was posted on March 30th, just kind of a discussion of going concern reporting and at least a perception on the part of this author of inadequacies on the part of the profession as it relates to issuing going concern reports. I sent Bella a chapter out of a book that the AICPA published in 1993, co-authored by Doug Carmichael, who most of you know, and Kurt Panny, on this very topic 15 years ago. And in that chapter, there were quotes in there from Representative Dingell, who I believe is still in the House, and at that point, Representative Wyden, who's now Senator Wyden, expressing serious legislative concern that auditors often would issue a clean opinion shortly before a bankruptcy filing. So regardless of how we may feel about this issue, clearly politicians, the business press, the general public views this as a major issue. This is part of the quote-unquote expectation gap. The public and legislators expect auditors to do well in this area. Next slide. First academic paper I looked at was one that I did with Zovana Palmrose about 15 years ago, and we studied auditor reporting and litigation within the context of client bankruptcy. We had a sample of about 655 public companies that declared bankruptcy over approximately a 20-year window that had been audited by a Big Six or Big Eight auditor. Now, the good news is that in the majority of those bankruptcies, there was no litigation against the auditor. Approximately three-quarters of the time, there was no litigation against the auditor. However, when there was litigation involved, in 24% of the time where there was litigation, auditors were defendants in the majority of that litigation. And the auditor litigation rate for bankrupt clients, 18%, is about six times higher than the estimated rate of litigation for all public clients. One thing that's interesting, and this I think gets at Steve's point, is the vast majority of the reports at issue in auditor litigation either did not involve or were not limited to the last pre-bankruptcy report. So sometimes the report right before bankruptcy may be too late to really shield you from litigation.
Next slide.
10% of the observations in the sample had only modified reports as the subject of litigation. 20% had some modified reports as the subject of litigation, some clean, and 70% of the observations have no modified reports as the subject of order to litigation, i.e. clean. So in 70% of the cases where there was litigation, there were no modified reports. There were only clean reports at issue. We also looked at resolution evidence, settlements, and judgments. Our resolution evidence indicates that observations with all modified reports have the highest dismissal rate and the lowest, both mean and median, payments by auditors. Observations with no modified reports, conversely, have the highest auditor payments. What's our punchline? Overall, our evidence suggests a defensive role for timely modified reporting. So then, as I said, we went and pulled data. And what we did is we used a source called the Bankruptcy Yearbook and Almanac. The most recent edition of that is 2008, which listed 2007 bankruptcies of public companies. There were 72 listed. We could get data for 66. 56% of these companies received a going concern report in the last 10K filed prior to bankruptcy. Where an unmodified report was issued, the median number of months between the audit report date and the bankruptcy date was 9 months. 12 months was the median between the financial statement date and the bankruptcy date. Now, I don't know if you think 56% is good or bad, but notwithstanding the above statistics, Hopwood, McCune, and Mutchler in 94 found that auditors are as good as bankruptcy prediction models in predicting bankruptcy, but that neither the auditor's opinions nor the bankruptcy prediction model are very good predictors of bankruptcy. We also then looked at size of client in this data that we pulled. For the 20 largest bankruptcies in the sample, only four going concern reports were issued. Okay? For the 20 smallest bankruptcies in the sample, 16 going concern reports were issued. So we're looking at a 20% rate for big companies and an 80% rate for small companies. I didn't want any statistics, guys, but that on its face is statistically significant. So the question then, and by the way, this is consistent with the overwhelming body of research that auditors are less likely to issue a going concern report to larger companies. So then the question is why? There's two possibilities at least, right? One is that larger companies may be more likely to survive. And I'm sure that's what my friends in practice will argue. The other possibility is that auditor independence may be adversely affected by the size of the client. There is one study that has examined this, McCune, Mutchler, and Hopwood, find that auditors are less likely to issue a going concern report to a larger client even after, okay, this is important, they statistically remove the link between client size and the likelihood of bankruptcy. So after statistically removing the link, that larger clients are more likely to live, they found that auditors were still less likely to issue a going concern report. Now, in fairness to the profession, this is pre-Sarbanes-Oxley. This is, you know, it's a long time ago. It's a 1991 paper. So I'm not casting aspersions on the profession today necessarily, but that was what the data said in 1991. 64% of the bankrupt companies had a note. So then I went and I said, okay, well, what's management doing? Okay, the FASB is speaking to management. So we're sure management must be Lily White. So let's see how Lily White they are. 64% of the bankrupt companies had a note in their financial statements in the last 10K before the bankruptcy related to the going concern issue, the note related to the going concern issue. 100% of the companies where the auditor issued a going concern report had a note in the financial statements, 37 out of 37. Let's see what the note said. 30 of the 37 mentioned the going concern in the 10K report using substantial doubt. Two of the 37 referred to the auditor's going. It was really funny reading this. It was like, these auditors are complete morons, but they gave us a going concern report, so we're telling you that. Okay? You could almost feel the tension in reading the note. Because all they said is the auditors gave us a going concern opinion. That was it. No recognition on the part of the management team that maybe that was well-founded. Three of the 37 referred to going concern but used conditional language, the problem that auditors used to have that was remedied by SAS 77, which precludes conditional language. But three of the 37 management teams used conditional language. Two of the 37, keep in mind, these all got going concern opinions by their auditors. Two of the 37 did not even refer to going concern in their note. They referred to liquidity, net losses, et cetera. Now, side note, paragraph 14 of AU 341 requires the auditor to evaluate the adequacy of management's disclosure regarding the going concern issue. I'd have a question on that last bullet, two of 37, but we'll leave that for a different discussion. Another question would be, if the auditors had not been required to issue a separate paragraph, as Randy and Steve talked about, how many of these companies would have issued the reports that we see, the notes that we see? It's an unknowable answer. It's an empirical question, as we like to say in academia. But given what we see here, I'm not confident that the level of reporting accuracy wouldn't degrade. Then, again, following the companies that got a clean opinion, what did they do? 17% of the companies where the auditor issued an unmodified report had a note in the financial statements, five of the 29. One of the five mentioned the going concern in the 10K note. I was impressed with that. The auditor gave a clean, but they said they had a going concern opinion in there, or going concern note. One of the five mentioned going concern using conditional language. Three of the five did not mention going concern. So they had a note, but they just discussed liquidity. Then we also polled. We said, okay, well, maybe the 10K is too far in advance of the bankruptcy. Well, surely the Q, the last Q before they filed, they'd come clean by then. So we looked at that. For the 24 companies with an unmodified report, and without a relevant note in the 10K, we examined the last Q filed before the bankruptcy date. 14 of the 24 did have a note of some relevance. Four of the 14 discussed the going concern issue. One of the 14 discussed the issue using conditional language. Nine of the 14 did not mention going concern. For the most part, just discussed liquidity. Okay. Then I also looked at the time period issue, this 12-month issue. of the 29 companies that received a modified report, six of these companies filed for bankruptcy more than 1 year after the financial statement date, which is the current standard, right? But less than 1 year after the audit report date. Now, although the FASB's original proposal didn't define what was more than 12 months, there's been discussion in the literature for a long time that maybe the right framework is 1 year, not from the financial statement date, but 1 year from the audit report date. And if you use that, about 21% of those companies went bankrupt in that window, and they had gotten a clean opinion in the prior year. So the question, I guess, again, it's an unknowable question, would the auditor have issued a going concern modified report if he or she had evaluated going concern for a reasonable period, which is at least but not limited to 12 months from the financial statement date? Moving on to audit procedures for evaluating an entity's ability to continue as a going concern, some firms may do this. There's an extensive literature on bankruptcy prediction models, although they're not necessarily better than the auditor. If the auditors use them in conjunction with their private information set, would their decisions be better? And all the way back to Ed Altman's work at NYU in the early 70s to Mark Majewski in 84 and Jim Olson in 80, there's issues of looking at cash burn rate and committed lines of credit, due dates on loans, bonds, compliance with debt covenants, evaluate changes in credit ratings and the price of credit default swaps on the company's debt. Again, for all I know, firms may be doing much of this, but these are things that certainly could be done. And these wouldn't be all that time-consuming to do. Evaluating an entity's projections and forecasts, there is literature on this. Auditors are significantly less likely to issue a going concern report when management discloses plans to issue equity or to borrow additional funds. These are two of the mitigating factors discussed in SAS 59. However, there is no significant relation between the auditor's opinion and management disclosures of plans to reduce spending or dispose of assets. So either the auditor is skeptical that that will be effective, or the auditor is skeptical that management will actually do that. Explanatory paragraph in the auditor's report, there's some discussion among the practitioners on the panel that maybe you don't need this. The Auditing Standards Board held a public meeting to obtain views of users on the usefulness of the going concern opinion all the way back in 1982. You know, this issue's been around a long time. And this is a quote, users attending the meeting argued that the subject to opinion qualification was valuable, that its elimination would be viewed as an attempt by auditors to avoid responsibility to investors. Does the market react to these opinions? A pretty extensive literature on this. Recipients of an unexpected report experience a significant negative stock price reaction. It clearly appears to matter to market participants. Also, companies receiving going concern opinions experience less negative excess returns in the period surrounding bankruptcy filings than those receiving unqualified opinions. Why? Because it wasn't a surprise, right? A going concern opinion had been issued before the bankruptcy, so it wasn't a surprise when the company finally went bankrupt. Other ideas on improving the auditing standard on going concern. Really no specific academic literature on this topic, so this is more my own personal take. I'd eliminate the language in the last two sentences of paragraph 4 of AU 341, which to me is just kind of cover yourself. Revise paragraph 11 of AU 341 to require, this is consistent with where I think the FASB is going to go, to require rather than consider disclosure, the auditor to disclose those conditions or events that initially caused the auditor to question the entity's going concern status, even if the auditor issues a clean opinion. If I heard Peter correctly, that was a change and so to the extent the FASB makes that change, it would seem if the PCAOB is going to have their standard somewhat in alignment with the FASB standard, they may want to think about that pretty seriously. And then add a communication requirement regarding the going concern to the audit committee, similar to paragraph 23 of ISA 570. Given that the FASB ED requires management to evaluate the going concern assumption on an annual and quarterly basis, Peter didn't talk about that, I don't believe, the board may need to revise its standards for the auditor's review of quarterly filings, SAS 100. And unlike AU 341, the FASB ED did not seem to define a going concern. Peter, I hadn't read the comment letters. As a result, might different companies apply the standard differently, but it sounds like that issue's now been remedied in what will be the final standard. Other findings from the academic literature, as Randy said, auditors appear to rely heavily on debt default status when making the going concern opinion decision. Chen and Church found that 98 out of 127 firms receiving a first-time going concern opinion were in default or in the process of restructuring their debt. They have a control sample of similarly distressed firms that did not receive a going concern opinion, and only one of 127 of those similarly financially distressed firms were in default. Notwithstanding that auditors appear to rely heavily on default status in making the going concern decision, default status does not appear to be a good indicator of bankruptcy. Maybe that's why only 56% of the opinions are qualified before bankruptcy. Last slide is a paper I did with my colleague Terry Neal, and we examine auditor dismissals following new going concern reports issued by Big Six auditors between 88 and 99. Again, keep in mind pre-Blue Ribbon Committee, pre-Sarbanes-Oxley. Audit committees with greater independence, greater governance expertise, and lower stock holdings are more effective in shielding auditors from dismissal after the issuance of a new going concern report. Very encouraging. However, independent audit committee members experience a significant increase in turnover rate after the auditor dismissal. So what does that mean? If they fail to shield the auditor, after the auditor is replaced, they go away. Either they resign from the audit committee or they're asked not to stand for re-election. To me, there are implications there for the new auditor's evaluation, right? There's a new auditor. There's some new auditor. For the new auditor's evaluation of the control environment, and I hope the board looks at that when they do their inspections.
Thank you, Joe. Quick question for you. The website that you referenced on your second slide, it's not named on the slide. Do you know what that website is? Because it looks like it was just a link.
Regarding the auditors.
Regarding the auditors,
yeah.
Is the website. Okay,
yeah,
thank you.
That's the name of the website.
Well, thank you very much to Peter, Randy, Steve, and Joe for their prepared remarks. I think before we focus on a discussion of the five areas outlined in our briefing paper, I'd like to take 5-10 minutes in case any of the SAG members or observers have any questions for our panelists at this time. Ted White, did you have a question or comment?
yeah, just a quick question. A couple of points on your last slide there, Joe, a little troubling, I think. The question, just out of curiosity from a couple of comments here, I was curious if any of the panelists believe, actually let me ask this two ways, if any of the panelists believe that an auditor's going concern statement, opinion, can be the deciding factor in pushing a firm under. And to ask that a second way, maybe just to make it the easy way to ask this, is do any of the panelists believe that auditors in general are fear that? Does that have an impact on behavior generally in the industry? And I would like that bifurcated, if you just a quick comment on that.
Let me try, Ted. I think it is one of those things that at every point in a conversation about a going concern modification, it comes up that you are going to cause our demise. So it's always there when you get to the point about whether you do or don't have substantial doubt. I think we take seriously that we wouldn't want to frivolously put a going concern of modification on a set of accounts that doesn't need it. And so to that extent, yes, we think about it. I don't think fear of it happening does it stops us from modifying our opinion when we believe it's appropriate. I think if there's ever a risk, it's much more in something like financial services, say a public bank, where because of the whole fear of a run on the bank, there might be a little more truth to the claim that a going concern modification causes the demise. I think with many other companies, it's an issue, it's a concern, but I don't think I would accept the fact that the mere fact there's a going concern modification suggests, you know, that that's going to happen. So I think it's a little more of a consideration perhaps in financial institutions, a public bank, but I guess I go back to I don't believe it at the end of the day stops us from modifying a report when we believe we should. Is that?
I think we feel exactly the same way, or I do. I know there are lots of auditors and lots of companies that believe that is a deadly blow. But again, I don't think it has ever stopped my firm from putting in concern modification.
Damon Silvers.
I'm interested in the panels. I mean, we have some rather unique circumstances around this issue facing us today, and I'm curious as to the panel members' reaction to how what the appropriate manner of handling the circumstance that we seem to have in two of our four largest banks and in our largest insurance company, where but for continued infusions of government money, all three of those institutions pretty clearly, in the opinion of their executives, would be insolvent and would have filed for Chapter 11, and where there is, seems to be some evidence that there will be continuing needs for cash in all three institutions. There, I think, can be no certainty that there won't be other institutions, other public companies in similar circumstances where their viability will depend upon future infusions of public money. I think that clearly means that those institutions cannot access private capital markets, which was something that several of you mentioned as one indicia of this matter. And the future availability of public funds is clearly dependent on political processes. I myself make it a professional practice of not predicting the outcome of political processes, which I found is a fair amount of basis in not doing. But it would appear that trying to puzzle this matter out from the perspective of going concern opinions would necessarily involve trying to make such predictions. And I am curious as to how the panel views the responsibility of auditors and by extension what the board ought to be doing in relation to this question.
I have some colleagues in the room who might be able to answer those questions, but seriously, Damon, I mean, those are too close to home to actual client situations. A number of those happen to be my clients, but I don't think I want to comment on whether or not a particular entity should have received a going concern modification from their auditor. I just don't think.
Well, I wasn't asking for anyone to say that. I'm asking how do you think about it? What is the appropriate that this circumstance exists obviously in some specific firms, and could exist in others. How should an auditor think about this question? Can I observe that if no one can answer this question, that is a very serious problem? Because this is, as Randy indicates, this is live and now.
Hal Schroeder.
I just want to ask, we're in a situation now where concerned entities may be continuing to survive. They may not change the legal structure, but you may have tremendous influx of capital to the point where you're massively diluting existing shareholders. Does that in and of itself trigger a going concern? Because the concern that those shareholders, the initial shareholder base, invested in has so dramatically changed, they are no longer the dominant shareholder. Someone else has come in. And as I read through all this, that thought kept coming up. Is that in and of itself the potential of being extremely diluted down? Should that also trigger a going concern? That may be a question more for the FASB. And I don't want to yield quite all my time because I do have a question on one of the slides.
I guess I'll give you the short answer. I don't think if you read the definition of a going concern or the indications of things that would contradict the going for an assumption, that a dilution of existing shareholders would meet the test. So
that
might be of great interest to you, but I don't think it meets the test of whether something no longer is a going concern.
Because that's a different concern going forward. That's why I asked the question. Could I come to my question now that I originally had?
I'm sorry?
Oh, is that, may I go ahead and ask my question now that, of Joe that I originally had?
Yes.
Oh, okay, thank you. Joe, on the top of page 11 in this handout that we have, you have a slide here that has a point on running bankruptcy prediction models. I wasn't clear on the point that you were making. Are you saying that you suggest that auditors run these prediction models?
It would seem to me that that's something you could do very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
The data is downloadable. And I think I won't mention the firm. I know one firm already runs something similar to this. Maybe others do as well. And depending upon the output of that model, it affects their risk assessment of the client, and then they adjust their audit procedures accordingly.
What you're suggesting here makes all sense in the world, because I know that the bank auditors themselves have recommended something very similar in evaluating loan portfolios. And what I was surprised is that your last study was only 1980, and I would have expected that there have been, during the 90s, there were tremendous revisions to those models and updates and improvements.
I picked what I view as the seminal papers, Hal.
Okay.
You know, sometimes the seminal papers are the early papers.
Ah.
There's been more recent work that has essentially updated the coefficients, which I think is what you're getting at, that would be attached to the various ratios.
Okay, so everything's pointing in the same direction.
Yeah.
And on that same slide, you say evaluate changes in credit ratings and the pricing of credit default swaps. I was surprised that you didn't mention stock movements.
I'm sorry?
I'm surprised that you did not mention stock movements. There have been some studies out there that suggest when you get single-digit stock prices, they don't come back.
No, you're right.
And they've actually been more accurate than credit ratings.
You're right. I think that's a fair addition.
Okay.
Galen Hansen.
I just have a quick question, and I direct it to Peter. In the proposal, and apparently in the international standards, it referred to all information about the future that you would take into account, but we dropped the word all at the FASB, and I was just sort of interested just what, because you didn't really say what the reason behind that was.
Yeah, the reason was there was a concern that using the word all implied that you'd have to go on, the auditor would have to go on, or management would have to go on a hunt and destroy mission to uncover every piece of data. So we just wanted to soften that, and so we put the focus more on relevant information that you can reasonably know.
Jim Cox.
Well, first of all, I want to thank Joe for taking the time to put these slides together. I thought it was really helpful, and it helped really discuss things. And my question really goes to, it's framed by something for Joe talked, and that is what kind of disclosures we could have to better facilitate efficient pricing of stocks in anticipation of going concern. And I wonder if there might be just a kernel of insight there provided by something that Joe has in a slide that looks like it's labeled here 33. In the consecutive order here, but the studies there where it's the unexpected opinion, going concern opinion, what made it expected? Otherwise, do you remember the studies? I mean, I don't remember those studies, but I wonder if you...
Generally, what made it expected were things like deteriorating financial ratios, recurring operating losses, cash flow deficits, a lot of the language, bluntly, that's in AU 341. So from public filings, you could look at this and you could say this company is likely to fail. Well, when you give them a going concern, that's really not new information to the market. But where it was more ambiguous based on the public filings and a going concern was issued, then it was a surprise and the market reacted in a significantly negative way.
But just to follow up there, we don't know whether part of the reason why in the unexpected situations, whether that was a result of cooking the books or otherwise masking things, it could have more likely we would just assume it was a rapid deterioration.
There is some work, Jim, and I looked at it, but I don't recall all the details because I didn't end up putting it in the slides, where they look at bankruptcy and they also have a variable as to whether or not there was a fraud that ultimately was related to that bankruptcy and how that affects both the ratios and the user judgment, but it's clearly an issue that you'd want to be aware of.
Bill Miller.
Yeah, I've got a question for you, Joe, in terms of your study and your analysis, in terms of how the analysis was designed. How did you go about doing that to remove factors such as rating agencies, reviews and things like that in terms of predictors of default? I guess I'm trying to get to the question of, do we already have enough out there in terms of a predictor of default that's more timely than once a year or on an annual basis going through all this and going through these, you know, excruciating experience of having to wrestle with all of these things that's different from an audit activity? Typical audit activity, I guess there's the two components of audit activity. One, which is the current facts of the financial statements, and the other is the look forward evaluation of all the uncertainty and things like that.
Was there, William, was there a particular slide in particular, or just more?
Well,
big
no, you talked about the experience for the 10-year period, that 72 to 92, and
yeah.
Was that the one that had 204?
655 bankruptcies.
Oh, no, I guess I was thinking about the 2007 where you had 204, I guess, and experiences, and 56% were given going concerns, and, you know, a portion of those actually went into bankruptcy. And
okay.
I'm just, you know, I see the results in the, of your study and the like, but I'm just curious whether you were able to isolate those solely to the going concern, or were there other factors that also weighed into that?
Well, if I'm understanding you right, all we did there is we pulled all the bankruptcy filings in 2007, and we just looked at the nature of the opinions that had been issued before the bankruptcy filing, the nature of the management disclosures in the notes, and the nature of the management disclosures in the 10-Qs, just to provide descriptive information so that the SAG members and observers had some baseline data as to what's going on now.
Okay, because when I saw those numbers, I looked at it, and it didn't suggest to me a very good predictive value based on, you know, the real question I'm trying to get to is, what's the values being added to, you know, the investor from this versus all the other information you've got in the material, the 10-Ks, the annual report?
I think that's
rating agencies, and I'd really be curious about how the rating agencies look at this stuff. And
I think that's in the eye of the beholder, William. You know, is 56% good or bad? And, you know, I mean, in fairness to the profession, you know, it's easy to be a critic. I think this is a tremendously hard thing to do and get right. And so I really have a lot of respect for what they try to do, because I think it's very hard to do well. The research would suggest that bankruptcy prediction models aren't any better. So it's not like, hey, just use a bankruptcy prediction model, it's better. To rely on credit rating agencies, they're not the most credible organizations in the world right now. And sorry, with all due respect, they've got their own set of problems right now. And I would say the auditing profession has come out of this period of time more unscathed than the credit rating agencies have. A lot of people are relying more on changes in the price of credit default swaps. That seems to be a more real-time indicator than changes in, let's say, a AAA to a single A and so
forth. Again, that's a better predictor than
now,
the auditor's report.
To the best of my knowledge, William, I'm not aware of any academic research that has examined the ability of changes in credit default swaps to predict bankruptcy. And maybe that's better than bankruptcy prediction models. Maybe that's better than auditors. Maybe that's better than changes in credit ratings. And maybe that's where we should go. I'm not aware of anybody who's looked at that.
Greg Jonas.
A little background about what I've learned about ratings and bankruptcy. The rating agencies don't try to predict bankruptcy, interestingly. If that were the model, then there would be two rating classes rather than 21. There would either be AAA or C. What the rating agencies try to do is rank ordinally on the 21-point scale credit risk and then publish statistics about historically a portfolio of securities ranked at a certain rate have a certain propensity toward failure or bankruptcy. So we can say, for example, that a portfolio of CAA-rated securities have a 65% chance of bankruptcy, even though we can't say that any one company within that portfolio we think we're predicting bankruptcy. So it's based on the laws of large numbers, and we're trying to only ordinarily rank companies on the scale. We're not trying to predict bankruptcy. It's really a fundamentally different thought process than the notion of trying to understand going concern. I'll have more comments about that when we get into the issues. But
thank you, Greg. Steve Rafferty?
Just an observation. I think Joe's done a fabulous job here putting together some really meaningful stuff. But, you know, with respect to the 56%, I don't know that we know that that is a good number, because that's 56% of the entities that went bankrupt. We don't know how many of them went bankrupt for reasons that didn't exist at the date of the prior auditor's report. And in today's environment, I think you see a lot of instances where companies are going bankrupt, but the conditions that drive them bankrupt didn't exist a year ago. So I don't know if the number is really 56% or not.
Wayne Collins.
For Joe, on the bankruptcy prediction models, what is the time period over which they are making their prediction generally?
They run them out different time periods. They all run out at least a year. Some have run out, some of these models have run out 3 to 5 years, as you'd expect, Wayne. Once you start getting out 2, 3, 4, 5 years, the predictive accuracy really starts to degrade in a very significant way.
Right. So I would assume then perhaps the auditor's predictive accuracy would also degrade to the same extent.
No question. Yeah. I think anything beyond a year or shortly longer than a year is very unreasonable to expect anyone to be able to do.
Hal Schroeder, and then we'll go on to the more detailed topics. So I guess we'll go on to the more detailed topics.
Well, I was just going to say on the understood the credit rating observation, and kind of directionally, we're dealing with the law of large numbers, and groups of credits tend to go bankrupt over certain time periods. The other meaningful statistic that we've looked at is not only the credit rating, but the gap between the credit and the CDS. There's an implied credit rating in the CDS, and once you get, and we've seen some as much as 8 and 9. Rating level differences between the CDS and the credit rating, and that's anything over 5 really starts to become predictive.
Well, thank you again to all our 4 panelists for starting this discussion. At this point, I would like to move on to the specific topics we outlined in the briefing paper. And the first topic I'd like to talk about is the time period for assessing going concern. As presented by Peter, the proposed accounting standard on going concern right now will go beyond 12 months and has some language regarding the foreseeable future. This is different than what's currently in the auditing standards, which basically caveated the going concern time period not to exceed 1 year beyond the date of the financial statements being audited. The PCAOB is considering proposing changes that would conform its auditing standard to the requirements in the FASB proposed accounting standard. This leads me to our first question. If the time period the auditor would use to evaluate an entity's ability to continue as a going concern is extended beyond a 12-month period following the end of the fiscal year as required by the board's auditing standards, how would that affect the overall audit of an issuer? Galen Hansen.
I'll speak up. Just a couple things. And in the world of small filers, I think even though it might not be intended, it does, believe it or not, happen where a delinquent filer might take advantage, let's say, of having a very short period of time to get from 1 year from the balance sheet date. And frankly, I think that the proposal to make it 1 year from the filing date makes a lot more sense, just to remove what might otherwise be an artificial incentive. Then the other thing, I guess, I mean, obviously, then it means that you're going to have to project out perhaps several more months in your management will, and obviously the auditor's going to have to test projections and other evidence over that period of time, including loan compliance, to make sure that you're going to meet those standards to remove the going concern qualification.
Wayne Collins.
I guess the proof will be in the exact language that is used. It wasn't quite clear as to the tightening up language. I heard things like it would generally be limited to a year, but I don't know what the word generally means. What are the circumstances where generally would not be appropriate? And I think it should be made clear that we're talking about a period perhaps shortly after a year. I mean, I think in the discussion that we just had, I heard it would be unreasonable to ask an auditor to go anything shortly beyond that one-year period because of the degradation of the forecasting process.
Any other comments regarding the time period? Waiting for the FASB to issue their final accounting standard? I understand. Okay, well, I guess let's move on to our next topic relating to evaluating audit procedures for evaluating an entity's ability to continue as a going concern. The PCAOB's auditing standards state that it's not necessary to design audit procedures solely to identify conditions and events that, when considered in the aggregate, indicate there could be substantial doubt about an entity's ability to continue as a going concern for a reasonable period of time, and that the results of the auditing standards performed to achieve the other audit objective should be sufficient for that purpose. It goes on to say the auditor should evaluate whether information that comes to the auditor's attention as a result of all the audit procedures performed indicates there could be substantial doubt about an entity's ability to continue as a going concern. Therefore, should the PCAOB standard on going concern require the auditor to perform procedures specifically designed to identify conditions and events that indicate that there may be substantial doubt about a company's ability to continue as a going concern for a reasonable period of time? If so, what types of specific procedures should the auditor perform in this regard? Hal Schroeder?
If you'd asked me this question a year ago, I would have probably said no. Nothing specific, and you'd know a going concern issue when you see it. But given what's going on here in D.C. with the banks, and the landscape has changed so much, and I'll put healthcare into the same category, I'm starting to lean toward having some very specific procedures that would look at the macro backdrop that an industry is operating in. Not just the company, but the industry collectively, how is it changing, and what implications does that have? And I know that to a certain degree that's already being done, but if that could be incorporated into this standard, it seems to make a lot of sense to me, given what we're dealing with today.
Greg Jonas?
I could have introduced this at any point in the discussion, but I choose to do it now because I think before one can think about procedures, you have to have a clear idea of what the goal is. And I've managed to confuse myself about what the concept of going concern is. I can identify at least four, and a fifth was put up earlier when we mentioned shareholder dilution. But my four are, do we mean that the company can't pay its debts when due per the debt contract? Does it mean Chapter 11 type reorganization, or does it mean out of bankruptcy reorganization, or does it mean liquidation? And until we can decide which of those we're talking about, I can't answer the question, what procedures am I trying to do, because I don't know what I'm trying to shoot at. My proposal is that we clearly define it, and my vote would be to define it in the first bucket as the ability to pay debts when due per the debt contracts. And I would make this discussion all about liquidity. Then I would attack the word substantial doubt. Again, before I decide on procedures, because I've managed to confuse myself about what substantial doubt means. Does it mean a 30% chance of a bad event, kind of the notion of reasonably possible? Does it mean a 51% chance of a bad event, the notion of more likely than not? Or does it mean a 75% chance of a bad event, the notion of probable? Again, until I can understand the probabilities here, I can't do procedures very well. Now, interestingly, at our table last night, we took a poll about what folks thought substantial meant. And we ranged from a low of 30% to a high of 75%, with someone at 51%. I mean, some of this is inherently uncertain. I understand that. But we shouldn't exacerbate that by using a nebulous word when we can just clarify what the heck we mean and at least take that uncertainty out of the question. My vote here is we should mean 30% reasonably possible and be clear about it. With those two things decided, then I can put my mind to this question, and I think things become a little clearer.
Bill Miller? Oh, Galen Hansen?
I would probably respectively disagree with you, Greg, on the issue of that this is solely on liquidity. In fact, I think liquidity, weak balance sheets and losses are more a symptom, and I was going to wait until we were talking about the reporting aspect of this, but I think the underlying causes of lack of liquidity is what would be more meaningful to investors, to users, in terms of knowing more specifics about why things are happening. Do we have labor issues, supply issues, marketing, pricing, reliance on a single product, any number of reasons? And I don't know that the auditor has to cover in detail each and every one of those in their report, but I think we're kind of fooling ourselves if we think that we've solved the problem by just saying we got a weak balance sheet, we have lost some money. I think that's one of the things that Joe's slides are showing us is we're sort of reporting these things after the fact, and we need to get ahead of the ball game here.
Jim Schnur?
First of all, I would agree with Greg that I think there is confusion about what substantial doubt means in terms of what the level of probability is. And then to pick up on something that Randy said, I think, in his remarks, if you look at the ISAs, they talk about material uncertainty. They don't talk about substantial doubt. And I think we would be much better off if the disclosure in the notes and then the auditor's opinion talked about material uncertainty, because I think we have better experience dealing with the word material in a lot of ways in our audit procedures as well as making judgments about the financial statements. So I think the disclosures would be clearer. I think there would be less confusion about what that meant. It would be a better description of what actually exists, that there are conditions that create material uncertainty.
Gary Kubarek?
This is really a question, Bella, to yourself and the PCOB team. If the FASB finalizes its exposure draft on it, I mean, that becomes an audited footnote in time when finalized, or the case maybe you don't have a disclosure of substantial doubt, you also audit for what's not there, but management has to prepare an assessment and assertion that either does or does not have substantial doubt. So you have to audit that. So with that as a backdrop, I'm not sure what this adds. Do you need this if the FASB standard is finalized, you know, at or near its current form? What does this do, the regular audit of footnote or the audit that I don't need this footnote already would do?
I think what this is trying to get at is similar to other types of procedures that are performed in other areas during an audit. Because this is such a sensitive topic, would an auditor be better positioned to actually perform very specific procedures regarding an entity's ability to continue as a going concern and management's assessment of that, actually focusing more directly rather than taking the other procedures they've performed on all the other areas and looking at that in the aggregate, but really targeting specifically this area, and would that be beneficial for them?
But I think what you should be doing is you'd be giving guidance on how to audit an area that you're required to audit, I think is what you're saying. I mean, because there's big companies got 25 or 30 footnotes. You don't have procedures on how to audit, the information in shareholders' equity footnote or any number of footnotes. Use the regular standards of due professional care and other audit procedures, looking for evidence in support or evidence that refute, management's assertion. So I don't have a problem with your writing this or requiring it, or say when management has these disclosures, here's the sort of steps the PCOB believes you should do. And presumably management, if I read the ED correctly, is going to have to do some form of an assessment. Hopefully most of the time they don't need any disclosures, but they still have to do the assessment. So you have to audit their assessment. So when I said, when you require the auditor to perform procedures specifically designed to identify conditions and events, identifying conditions and events, I think that's what the FASB is asking management to do. So you might rearticulate the question, say, when FAS 162 or whatever its final number is comes out, here are the procedures we believe are appropriate in the general circumstances. So again, this will become an audited footnote. So.
Steve Rafferty.
A couple of observations here. One on the notion of procedures. I don't believe there's really a need to do that, because I think we are almost always, if not always, aware of the conditions and events that might give rise to substantial doubt. By virtue of the work that we do already, that might only be enhanced if management has a responsibility to do the same thing. I tend to gravitate more towards the international approach of disclosing the material uncertainties that might cast doubt. I think that is a possibility to, with adequate disclosure, raise the red flags that readers need. And I think I agree with Greg that this is all about liquidity. It's not, however, just about the balance sheet, to say we have a weak balance sheet. It's liquidity for whatever reason, whether that's a regulatory action, whether that's a bank restructuring debt action, whether that loss of a material customer, whatever that is. But at the end of the day, it drives a liquidity issue, which is the way 341 is written today. And I think that's where we need to probably stay with that.
Joe Carcello.
I think there's a couple of reasons why the auditor's opinion is valuable. The auditor's going concern opinion is valuable, even over and above management's note. One is that I don't think we can assume that all financial statement readers read the 10-K from cover to cover. They're different clientels. And one clientele may be a user who looks at the audit report and looks at the financials and moves on. And by having an auditor paragraph in the audit report, there's some value. A second thing is that some users like to be able to set up electronic screens. These electronic screens can be based off of audit analytics or other similar databases. And until the notes are XBRL tagged, which then my understanding is the XBRL taxonomy has not yet encompassed all the notes, they wouldn't be able to do that, where they can do a search off of the opinion itself. A third reason is more subtle, but when the FASB standard is issued, you may have a situation where there are some notes that, let me use the word, they're borderline. It's a borderline issue as to whether the note really meets the FASB standard. You could make an argument on either side. And to the extent that the auditor has the ability to add a paragraph on going concern, the auditor may conclude the note, we can defend the note, it's borderline, but we can defend the note. And we've got a paragraph in here talking about going concern, so users are alerted.
If you eliminate that order to paragraph, now the note issue is a make or die issue, right? Because that's it. If the note doesn't adequately communicate, the auditor has no other meaningful way of communicating it. Now what's the decision? The decision is a clean opinion or what? A qualified opinion. And my understanding is the SEC does not accept qualified opinions for gap departures. And so that becomes an even more contentious issue than the going concern issue is now.
Jim Schnur? Randy Fletchall?
Well, just one comment on this one, and I know as you go through the rest of your questions to talk about possible changes to the standards and on reporting, we talked about the definition of a going concern. I mean, one of the things that troubles me is we are having this conversation now, and the FSB is about to finalize its project. And one of the things I don't think we want to end up with is, you know, a lack of symmetry between the accounting standard and the auditing standard. And yet I think, you know, that's why, again, I say I wish this all would have happened a little earlier. The accounting standard, rightfully so, was kind of picked up, as you said, existing definitions of going concern, additional existing language about substantial doubt. So if you're serious about the need to make changes to the auditing standard, other than this one that says what procedures might an auditor do, we really need to resolve the timing of the FASB going forward with this project, because you're just going to end up creating something that doesn't match, or else we're really not spending our time very wisely.
Well, is to read the accounting standard once it is issued by the FASB, and then look at it and consider AU 341 in light of that, and what changes potentially would need to be made. So I think we're all on the right track. We're just, we all wish we could have been talking about the same thing at the exact same time. Any other comments on this topic? Oh, Sam Renzillo?
Well, Bill, I'm not sure I agree with what you just said, that you'll wait until the FASB is all done and then decide. Let's say you decide we ought to get rid of the word substantial doubt, but substantial doubts in FAS 162 sounds like a disaster. So I think that, you know, before either of you go forward, the FASB or the PCAOB, I think we better be certain the direction each of you are going to take. Otherwise, you know, I think we messed it up. As it relates to your question here, I don't believe that there are prescriptive procedures, and I would suggest that your inspection process would be a place to look to as to whether or not, you know, whether you agree or disagree that auditors are making the right calls on going concern, and, you know, whether you believe that or not, this question goes to, are auditors identifying the situations that would lead you to a going concern discussion, and then to assess management's plans? And I would argue that this is not an issue that is looking for prescriptive guidance. Maybe to Joe's slides, one could argue that auditors aren't predicting whatever it is substantial doubt is asking us to predict, but I don't think it's because, you know, we just sleep through the issue that this company is in some degree of financial stress. And I think that's what that question goes to.
Larry Salva?
Yeah, I would agree with Sam that I don't, on this specific question about, I don't believe that you need to prescribe specific procedures. I think once it becomes a FASB standard, along the lines of what Gary was getting at before, the auditor will have to read and evaluate the assessment that management has made and perform whatever appropriate procedures, you know, on that assessment to audit that footnote. And on the other issue of the integration of the audit standard with the accounting standard or financial reporting standard, I would suggest is that the staff indicated in a footnote, I think, in the briefing paper here, that you would consider the ISA 570 requirements as part of a standard-setting project. Well, that seems to be, even though the IAS is, it doesn't have a lot ongoing concern other than the going concern assumption is fundamental to the preparation of financials, the ISA standard does seem to be kind of integrated and going after, as Jim said, the uncertainty issue. And I do think that's a better way to approach the resolution of this, but that can only be done if it's coordinated with the FASB action to eliminate the kind of strike words, if you will, of substantial doubt and get it focused on the uncertainties that that really run to the heart of the matter.
Okay, any other comments on this topic? Then we'll move on to our next topic, evaluating an entity's projections and forecasts. The PCAOB auditing standards require the auditor to consider management's plans for dealing with the adverse effects of conditions and events that indicate that there is substantial doubt about an entity's ability to continue as a going concern. When prospective financial information is particularly significant to management's plans, the auditing standards require the auditor to request that management provide the information and to consider the adequacy of support for significant assumptions underlying that information. The auditing standards also state that the auditor's consideration should include reading the prospective financial information and the underlying assumptions and comparing prospective financial information in prior periods with actual results and comparing prospective information for current period with results achieved to date. So the question is, what should the auditor's responsibilities be for evaluating an entity's assumptions, such as projected cash flows, underlying a forecast, when mitigation of the adverse effects of events or conditions is based on management's forecast? Tom Teft?
I would say to carry out the responsibilities here, the auditor does need to look at the forecast and the underlying assumptions. I do think, though, it's got to go beyond just a financial analysis. You need to understand what are the operating assumptions behind those financial forecasts, and specifically to the extent those forecasts are going to suggest a change in trajectory of the financials of the underlying business, you need to understand what's going to change. What's going to change from an operating standpoint, either from an action standpoint, a assumption standpoint, something that's going to trigger a change in the overall performance. I don't think it's going to be sufficient just to compare the current forecast to past forecasts or compare actual results to past forecasts. You got to go a little bit deeper than that.
Ted White.
And I realize the statistics that Joe had were a bit old, but I think those would apply directly to this and would require a very high bar, right? If I understood what he presented, it meant that management's arguments contrary to the going concern opinion were, what in almost all cases, wrong, right? Their arguments to the contrary. Right, so I think that, if I'm understanding your question correctly, that would lead you to require a very high bar.
Wayne Collins.
341 and ISA 570 have similar language. 341 talks about considering the adequacy of support for the significant assumptions, and 570 talks about evaluating the reliability of underlying data to generate the forecast and determining whether there's adequate support for the assumptions, which is, I think, pretty close to a, quote, examination of a forecast that's already in the literature. So in terms of just kicking the tires to look at things that should have changed even though management didn't, you're looking at from both ends of the glass in this case. So I think that is a pretty high bar, and I think it's an appropriate bar.
Any other comments? Oh. Bob Dacey.
I just wanted to add a similar comment that ISA
570 includes several procedures which are beyond merely reading, and I think that provides a reasonable framework for the auditor's responsibilities in this area.
Steve Rafferty.
I would echo that. I think what's already in the standard about challenging the assumptions and which assumptions are most important is already there. I think maybe auditors need to go back and read it from time to time, but I think the guidance is adequate. The way I read Joe's slide was to say that auditors are challenging those assumptions and are finding that they can't rely on that near as often as they can rely on financing vehicles to overcome the substantial doubt. I think that's what his slides tell us, is that the management's assumptions are not nearly as reliable as it could be.
Now let's move on to the disclosure in the auditor's report. After considering the identified conditions and events and management's plans for mitigating the adverse effects, the auditor may conclude that there's substantial doubt about an entity's ability to continue as a going concern remains. The auditing standards require the auditor to include an explanatory paragraph in the auditor's report that's been stated earlier. The standard indicates that the auditor's conclusion about the entity's ability to continue as a going concern should be expressed through the use of a phrase, substantial doubts about the entity's ability to continue going concern, or similar wording that includes the terms substantial doubt and going concern. The FASB's proposed accounting standard would require the company to make certain disclosures either when financial statements are not prepared on a going concern basis or when there is substantial doubt about an entity's ability to continue as a going concern. The PCAOB is considering retaining the explanatory paragraph in the auditor's report to highlight the going concern issue, even if the entity is required to make such disclosures. Therefore, if the FASB proposal to require disclosures about an entity's ability to continue as a going concern is adopted, what, if any, changes should be made to the explanatory paragraph in the auditor's report relating to going concern? For example, should the explanatory paragraph be retained substantially in the current form? Should the additional information be added to the explanatory paragraph? And if so, what information? Or should the explanatory paragraph refer only to management's disclosures and conclusions as described in the notes to the financial statements? I know several of our panelists made comments regarding this before, but we'd like to hear the SAG members' views. Steve Rafferty, do you still? Shelley Stein?
I think that the assertions and the financial statements of the notes there too are those of management. So the auditor's report should only refer to management's disclosures in the footnotes, and I don't think the auditors should be making statements and conclusions within their audit report.
Larry Salva.
Yeah, I'd agree with Shelley and actually like the way that 570 approaches it, where which I think you allude to in your footnote 16 here, is that if management has made inadequate disclosure, then a gap departure exists. And the way IAS 570 or ISA 570 approaches that is if that gap disclosure is inadequate, you modify your report appropriately, and then the auditor is called on to point out that there's significant uncertainties that lead to, you know, they use softer words, I think, which actually I think might be useful to consider here, significant doubt as opposed to substantial, and may cause it as opposed to there is substantial doubt. It just softens it up a little bit. I don't know if the representatives from the public firms would think any of their difficult decisions with their or discussions with their clients would be any easier if you weren't fighting over such harsh words as saying you think I'm going to fail in the next 6 months.
Larry, are you recommending that it be changed to may instead of is? I'm just kind of wondering if it's a may, does that expand the number of companies that you would see disclosures or have this, you know, opinion in the auditor's report?
Yeah, and actually if it does, that's a good thing. because I don't think that this should be just like kind of the last red flag that you get. You know, if there are, you know, significant concerns and very significant uncertainties, I think this type of uncertainty where it runs to the primary premise upon which you're the basis of presentation of the financial statements, that, you know, everything is done as if you're going to continue to, you know, realize your assets and discharge your debts in the normal course of business. If that premise is being called into question because of the existence of significant uncertainties, that's an important fact, and people should be made aware of it with either an emphasis or some reference in the report. And if it may cause doubt, the fact, what's factual is the uncertainty exists. So you would say there is uncertainty, and that may cause significant doubt about ability to continue as going concern. I think that's what you want to communicate, and if that brings in more companies, so be it.
Bill Miller.
Yes, I want to agree with Shelley's point, but to the extent that that's not adopted, I would like to at least identify that there's an assumption on the table here that by the auditors opining on this going concern, that it adds value to investors, and being stated in the opinion. And I'd like to challenge that and at least get some analysis that could evaluate that, because, you know, investing is very different today than where it was when those studies were done. But in particular, index funds. At one point, they were over $1 trillion, with the market move, obviously, and they're in the hundreds of billions. But when you put a going concern language into the audit opinion, then my observation is that has an impact on the price of the stock, because it's impacting the cost structure of the company. And as an investor in index funds, you can't get out of that. You have to hold the position. But if you are a knowledgeable investor, you've got all kind of other information out there that's giving you whether that entity is a going concern. You've got your information, your 10-Ks, you've got the rating agencies, you've got the CDSs, then you've got the analysts that cover the stock. So my view, my sense is a lot of the information that the auditors are trying to get at is already out there, and if you take the view that the market's efficient as well, so that my sense is there may be some costs now into the equation that I'd like to at least challenge that assumption.
Any other comments on the audit expenditure paragraph? Charlie Niemeyer.
I'm just seeking a clarification. It's something Sam, you said, and Larry said earlier, but I just want to make sure I understand. And certainly we intend to coordinate our efforts with FASB, but I may not have understood your comments about this, and a lot has been said about the ISA and stuff. And are you suggesting that our approach has been to wait for FASB, right, and to let FASB take the lead, and then we would do follow-up? And I'm getting the impression that you're saying don't necessarily take that approach. If you think that, if, for example, material uncertainty focus should be the emphasis, maybe that should be something that we should be more proactively involved with. Is that the comment?
I won't speak for Sam or Larry, but that was what I was trying to say earlier when I teed up the fact that if the FASB finishes its project, you're very limited as what you do if all you say is I can follow FASB, but in essence I want to keep symmetry, then all the things we're talking about as alternatives, frankly, are off the table. So that was really the point of it, Charlie.
Fine, thank you.
Yes.
Yeah, and Charlie, I'd say that this is one that I have to say didn't get my attention or focus at all. So that, you know, if I think, you know, that what Randy I think was saying before is that if we had had this discussion, this robust discussion back in October, and vetted out some of these issues, maybe we would have influenced or responded differently to the FASB project and suggested that they take out words like substantial doubt or and focus on uncertainties and kind of sync it up more. But that's, I'd be in favor of trying to coordinate this with the FASB and trying to stop them from issuing that standard immediately so it could be better coordinated.
Okay, thank you.
Paul Beswick.
I'll try not to get emotional over this issue either. I think you guys already asked the question I was going to ask, but it seems like the FASB's relying on the existing standard, and we get into a chicken and egg situation where they've pulled it forward without reconsidering it. And now we're talking about what should the auditing standard be reconsidered when we want symmetry here. And so, am I misinterpreting the message from members here that maybe we need to go call the FASB and say, wait a minute, don't do this, let's reconsider this? I mean, is that what I'm hearing from the people? And maybe the FASB and the PCOB need to look at this together? Or am I missing what people are saying? All right. Just want to make sure I wasn't misinterpreting anything.
Steve Rafferty.
Just an observation. If we were to go down a path where we reference to a footnote on material uncertainty, I think that's a lower threshold than substantial doubt, and that we would pick up a lot more entities and we'd be focusing a lot more folks on the material uncertainties that are there. And assume for a minute that Joe's statistics were right, that the 56% we get 56% of the time we get it right. That would mean that 44% of the time folks are relying on us when we get it wrong. And would we be better off saying, let's tell them more often about the red flags and the material uncertainties than have them inappropriately rely on the fact that we didn't actually conclude there was substantial doubt? It seems to me there's a possibility we better serve readers by doing that.
Gary Kubarek.
I'm going to put this comment in the sort of thinking aloud category. You know, intuitively, I like the idea that the footnote describes it all and just get a simple, clean opinion because it's buried in the footnotes. But given the nature of what this is about, I mean, this is going to be among the more important disclosures, one would think, if this is a serious issue going to have. And if one of the concerns that I'm hearing on the table is if management is minimizing the disclosures to the point where you could have an argument, are you complying with GAAP, just getting in, but the auditor sort of knows in his heart of heart, maybe you really should have more. So the only place to put more if you can't win management is in your report. Now, does that become an exception in the report, because you have inadequate GAAP disclosures? I'm just going to throw out in the room or for you to think about later on, you might be doing the auditing firms a favor requiring this explanatory paragraph, because that allows, one, it brings emphasis to it, and to the extent that they're uncomfortable that the footnotes aren't quite where they should be, appear to be but really aren't. You're helping them, avoid a conflict with management by saying, look, I've got to have something in my audit opinion. It's in the wondering aloud category. I intuitively do like the idea of just rely on the footnotes and a clean opinion, but I think, excuse me for being repetitive, but I think given the importance of the subject, companies could be forgiven that they're trying to put the best foot forward in the footnote. The auditors sort of, no, it sounds good, but, so just a thought.
Wayne Cornell.
Actually, I'd just like to ask a question to Joe, if I could, in terms of this issue about, a clean opinion or having an emphasis paragraph. I was wondering if there's been any academic studies comparing the U.S. model to the Canadian model, because in Canada, you're actually prohibited from issuing an emphasis paragraph. And what is interesting, when the Canadian companies file with the SEC, and there's some 500 of them, they do have a going concern opinion or going concern situation, they'll issue a special report for the U.S. filing. And I was wondering if there's been any comparisons to compare the U.S. disclosures with the Canadian disclosures, because the requirements are the same. And I was wondering, in terms of market reaction, information for investors, there's been any comparison, one is better than the other, or the advantages or disadvantages?
Wayne, I don't think so. I mean, there's so many academic journals, it's hard to think through every single journal. But the major journal in Canada is called Contemporary Accounting Research, which is viewed as a top-tier journal in North America. And to the best of my recollection, I don't recall ever seeing something like that. When I get back, I'll look, in recent issues of CAR, see if I see anything, and if I do, I'll send you an email. But I don't think so.
On to our last topic. Lastly, the board is interested in any other ideas or thoughts the SAG has on how to improve the auditing standard on going concern. I know that Joe and several other panelists provided their thoughts on some improvements, but I'd like to ask the whole standing advisory group, what additional changes to the auditing standard on going concern should be considered to assist auditors in conducting an audit of an issuer? Jim Schneider?
One area, I think, is if, in terms of the FASB's proposed standard, they bring in a requirement for the interim. And right now, there's really not a lot of guidance from a review standpoint. So I think that you would have to address that issue.
Anything else? You're tired, you want to go home? You want us to work with the FASB, I understand. Okay. Well, in that case, I want to thank everyone, including special thanks to our panelists for doing additional research and background and providing context to this very important issue. And at this point, I'd like to turn it over to Jennifer.